If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Throughout history, people have got tattooed for a huge range of reasons, whether religious devotion, artistic expression, or to demonstrate cultural belonging, or even to demonstrate cultural difference. In today's episode, Dr. Matt Lodder talks to Charlotte Hodgman about his new book, Painted People, Humanity in 21 Tattoos, which explores everything from the punishment tattoos of ancient China to the pilgrim tattoos adopted by Victorian aristocrats, including a future king.
Okay, so why don't we start then perhaps with you just telling us a little bit about the book?
I've been working on this stuff for a very long time. I mean, at least since my PhD, which I finished in 2010. I mean, probably even before that, really. I initially, you know, was trying to do something more straightforwardly, you know, history of tattooing, that was more narrowly constrained to, again, stories that haven't really been told about the industry and about the key players involved, and particularly trying to take this art historical approach of thinking and not just about, you know, the kind of chronological or sociological aspects of tattooing, but really think about it as an artistic practice, or at least, to be clear, think about it in the same ways we think about other forms of creative practice. But it ended up, when we ended up pitching the book, it became something a bit different to a history of tattooing. I think I call it in the book specifically a history through tattooing. You know, art history as a discipline has these big claims that we can kind of understand people and places in the past by looking at the objects that they've made. And I guess, like, underpinning everything in the book is, like, if that is true for altarpieces, if it's true for the kind of art we see in galleries and country houses and palaces and stuff, like, that must be true also for the kind of art that people wear on their bodies. And actually getting to those images and thinking about them as images, you know, of products of individual lives, but also products of moments in time and particular places with their own histories, you can get access to some stories or some insights into things that maybe other kinds of investigation don't get you to, right? So I was really surprised that, you know, there's a lot of history of tattooing in the book, but we also get to some places like copyright law and the beef trade during the Cold War and the ancient Persian postal system and the care of children in the early 20th century and, you know, the limits of archaeology as a method. Like, all of these things anchored on really interesting and fun stories, I think, about tattooed people from history. But we can use those tattoos to get to much bigger stories, I think, than tattoos are often used to tell, you know, which are often just much more narrow and much more personal.
Mm, yeah. It's interesting you mentioned about the archaeology, because obviously tattooing goes back a long, long time. What kind of evidence are we kind of looking at? Because obviously skin goes. How do we know about tattooing sort of in ancient times?
Yeah, my friend Gemma Angel, who's a historian of like preserved tattoos, names her blog Life Plus 6 Months, after a quote that I use in the book from a guy who was a tattooer and academic. He, you know, he said tattooing is a mayfly art, right? It lasts as long as you're alive and then rots away in the ground for a few months and then it's gone. You know, as much as we're worried about tattoos being permanent, or as much as my mother at least is worried about tattoos being permanent, they don't last that long. But of course, like, just sort of by accident, or in some cases through deliberate preservation, in the case of, for example, Egyptian mummies, tattoos have survived the centuries and millennia. There's not many of those very, very old ones. I mean, literally fewer than a few dozen. There's a constantly updated list that some colleagues of mine who are archaeologists make of mummies with tattoos. But from the few that we have got, from cultures, you know, from South America, from Egypt, from Europe, and elsewhere, all across, for example, Siberia, we can start learning what tattooing was like in the past. And in some cases, they're very, very individual data points. Like, the first chapter in the book is a story of Otzi the Iceman, who is, at least for the moment, the oldest preserved tattooed man that we have. He's from about 5,500 years ago, died on the Austro-Italian Alps, murdered, shot in the back with an arrow, left to die in the snow. His body was sort of revealed in the early 90s as climate change began to melt the snow around him. He's covered in tattoos. He's got these little tally marks all over him. But he's the only person from his culture that we've ever found. And actually, we don't really know anything else about his cultural background, let alone about him as an individual. Been loads of amazing scholarship done on him, the things he had for dinner and how his shoes were made. But his tattoos are really interesting because they are potentially medical in nature, or kind of medico-magical. They are little tally marks, crosses and dashes on sites of his body where he has, it seems, inflammation or other kinds of potentially pain. So maybe the tattooing was thought to be itself therapeutic, or maybe it was meant to invoke some kind of spiritual or magical response. Maybe, you know, the physical response of getting tattooed, all those endorphins and blood rushing to the area, was thought to be curative. We just don't know. And in fact, because we know nothing else about his cultural tradition in that period, which is, you know, basically the early Bronze Age, called the Copper Age, between the Iron Age, we just have to kind of infer. But then we have relatively the same age, for example, in Egypt, mummies that died pre-dynastic Egypt, so who died in the deserts of Egypt, who weren't actively preserved and wrapped, but just whose bodies happened to desiccate and were preserved by pure chance. And those specimens, those bodies, those people had tattoos on them, which are starting to be revealed through modern imaging techniques. They're not often visible with the naked eye, but you put them through ultraviolet light, or you put them through other kind of magical machines that go ping if you're an archaeologist. And we're revealing it literally, you know, very, very regularly now, as these studies are being done on specimens that have sometimes been in archaeological collections and museums for over 100 years. For example, big pictorial tattoos of bulls or of sheep or of decorative designs that are found elsewhere on other kinds of decorative forms. So in those cases, in the case of those Egyptians, for example, we can find real interesting commonality between the tattoos and the kind of things people were putting on pots and on mosaic and on rock art and things, and kind of infer that, yeah, tattooing is part of the visual life world of these people. And that, I think, again, from a contemporary point of view, is quite understandable, right? People are getting tattooed on them, the images that they see around them. In our day, it might be things they see on Instagram. back in pre-dynastic Egypt, sort of, you know, 3,500 years before the birth of Christ, we have, you know, tattoos of things that we find on pots and on ceramic ware and things like that.
And do we have an idea how these tattoos were actually done?
Yeah, I mean, again, interesting research is being done on those specimens that we have, and there's some really interesting work being done as we speak. So Otzi's, it seems that they were done by an incision method. So by opening up the skin, creating those little tally marks or crosses with a sharpened blade of some kind, whether that was obsidian or whether that was sharpened flint, you know. And then you rub soot from the fire and then it heals over. Basically, to make a tattoo, really all you need is a way of creating a wound to sufficient depth in your skin and something to make a pigment out of. Carbon black from a fire or soot from an oil lamp will do. And in the Pacific, often those tattoos are also done with plant pigments, so things that come from particular species of plants. But with the Egyptian ones, they seem more likely to have been done with some kind of, again, quite recognisable to modernised needle techniques. And there's really interesting work happening now with archaeologists, particularly in the Americas, who are going back to artefacts that have been documented for a long, long time as needles used for sewing or needles used for leather working or needles used for medicinal purposes. And by looking at them very closely under microscopes, looking at them very closely with new scientific analysis, you can try and disambiguate needles used for tattooing because they round off in a certain way and they have pigment marks on them, as compared to ones that were used for other kinds of handicrafts. That's harder to do in places where tattooing was done with metal implements because the wear patterns are not quite so discernible. But yeah, like remarkably, I think tattooing hasn't changed very much in 5,500 years. You just need something sharp and an ability to put some pigment in, you know, and the specific techniques do vary a bit depending on time and geography, but that's the basic technique. I mean, there was an idea for a long time in the early 20th century that tattooing was so weird and so surprising and so odd, and why would anyone do that to themselves, as far as Western anthropologists were concerned, that it must have come from somewhere, that someone must have kind of invented tattooing and it must have spread. But I think the more plausible version is that tattooing is something that can happen quite easily by accident. You can cut yourself by the fire, or a spark or a hot piece of unburnt material can explode from a fire, embed itself in your skin, heal over, that it sparks the idea that this might be possible to use in a more direct way. And then we're off to the races, right? So I think more plausibly, we have several origin points for tattooing around the world over deep historical time, like right back probably at least 40,000-45,000 years ago, and maybe even longer.
That's really interesting, and it does make you wonder why there is still so much, like you're saying, people say it's a permanent thing, you know, what are you doing? Yeah. And it's this old and yet still got those same sort of questions. Are those sort of questions or those sort of arguments against tattooing, do they go back a long way? Is that a historical feeling?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, one of the reasons really why that kicks in European thought is that in the big kind of intellectual progenitors of current, you know, European thinking, so the ancient Greeks, for example, and the ancient Romans, like they didn't have mainstream tattoo traditions in their own cultures. They did have tattooing around them in the cultures that they were conquering, and they had tattooing in a sort of subcultural sense within the borders of their empire. But so very, very early on, you know, several thousand years ago, at least in European thought, tattooing was this thing that demarcated some people from some other people. And so tattooing has this kind of stigmatization within it, right? And as certainly the kind of early modern period onwards in Europe develops, we get this idea that almost like tattooing is something that primitive races do and white Europeans don't do. We've sort of evolved out of it. You know, that's an idea of cultural teleology. In the early versions of that thinking, right, we have when the Europeans first encounter the Americas, when Columbus first set foot in the Americas in the late 15th century, there is an idea actually that like finding tattooed people in the Americas reminds people back in Europe of the tattooed people they'd read about in their own history and gone, oh, okay, these people are just like us. It's quite a humanist account of tattooing in the late 15th, early 16th century. It is coded in this kind of, you know, problematic evolutionary way of like, oh, well, they're a bit behind us in some kind of timeline and we're obviously better than them. But actually, tattooing proves they're just like us. By the time we get to the 18th century and the colonization and the more active age of sail and the age of empires, particularly that period of the Pacific, as I lay out in the book, that conversation changes quite rapidly, actually, where tattooing, far from being something that connects us to people, us being white Europeans, to people that we're encountering elsewhere in the world, is actually something that, again, demarcates them as different and fundamentally different. Very, very quickly into the 19th century, this idea embeds itself in European thinking that Europeans had never been tattooed, and there was no tattooing ever in Europe, and or if there ever was, we'd forgotten all about it. And so tattooing was this primitive, barbaric, almost inhuman thing to be doing, and something which is separating white Europeans from people elsewhere in the world. And yeah, you know, so much of that thinking, of its permanence, it's the pain of the kind of messing with your God-given body, all of those things that embed very, very deeply in, you know, certainly from the kind of, yeah, early modern periods to the present day. And so much, again, as I lay out in the book, through a kind of intellectual history of this stuff, through stories of, you know, this is a good example of a story that I'm telling about two thieves who rob this drunk guy in London in the 1840s, Jane and Mary. Through their story, we get to some of this intellectual history of why tattooing criminality and why tattooing and deviance are so intertwined, and why those feelings, despite these long histories, are so, you know, inextricably interlinked, despite the efforts of historians over the years.
Yeah, because there is definitely a tendency to, particularly kind of in sort of Western thinking and British thinking, is that it was something that sailors did, that, you know, criminals did. But actually, in the book, there's some great stories about Victorian aristocrats, and even the future Edward VII had a tattoo. Can you tell us some of the stories from that sort of period?
Yeah, well, the only reason we have a tattoo industry in the West is because of aristocratic patronage, right? So there'd been some professional tattooing, by which I mean going in and paying someone you didn't know to get tattooed in the United States as early as the 1850s. Before that, lots of tattooing going on, including in public schools and including amongst aristocrats, actually, but in a much more intimate and vernacular way, right? You'd get tattooed by friends or by colleagues, you know. But it takes the encounter with Japan, the opening up of Japan to the West in the late 1850s, to really kind of make tattooing visible as an art form. And because in that moment, like in the latter half of the 19th century, everything that's Japanese is super trendy, tattooing is really part of that. And yeah, Edward VII, before he was king, when he was sort of sent off in the aftermath of Prince Albert's death by Victoria to sort of grow up, was tattooed on a pilgrimage in Jerusalem. Pilgrims had been getting tattooed in the Holy Lands right back to the late 16th century. Kind of a done thing, even to the present day. If you go as a pilgrim to Jerusalem, as a Christian pilgrim, you can get tattooed with something halfway between a mark of religious devotion and a holiday souvenir. Edward VII had that done in 1861. And then, inspired by him directly, his two sons, Albert Victor, who died before he could ascend to the throne, and then the future King George V, Prince George, were both tattooed in Japan and then subsequently in Jerusalem as well. George writes back to his mother, you know, I got tattooed just like Papa. And of course, like, everyone wants to copy the royals, or certainly did in the 19th century. And both in the UK and on the continent of Europe and in the United States, the habits of the royals become, you know, something that everyone else wants to aspire to. And so in the kind of House of Lords, in the smart corners of Mayfair, and in John Jermyn Street, and in the United States, in New York, in the racket clubs and the elite men's clubs, getting very fashionable Japanese style tattoos, either of very Japanese designs or sometimes copies of your favorite paintings, scenes of hunting and, you know, grouse coursing and things that you might do if you're a rich, wealthy member of the House of Lords, become de rigueur. And that, for the first time, makes it possible for tattooists to charge money and make a singular living as working tattoo artists, you know. So we have kind of royal patronage and royal interest and money in the business to thank for everything that comes afterwards, you know.
Still to come, on the History Extra podcast.
You could, in ancient China, be charged with a list of what were called ink crimes. So everything from kind of stealing to repetitious adultery. And if you did it severely enough, you know, and you were caught enough times, you would end up being tattooed in a place that was visible.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So it's interesting you say about there are certain fashions in tattooing. Yeah. What other examples have you got of where today probably, you know, you think of stars and butterflies and things like that are kind of all kind of very common images that you sort of see on people's bodies. Are there any other examples of fashionable tattoos from the past?
Yeah. So we have that Japanese stuff, which is, again, it's a very straightforward art historical story, right? You'll sort of look for it in vain in the indexes of catalogues to Japonism, but literally people are getting tattooed the same designs that are coming from Japanese prints that people are putting on ceramic ware and on furniture, the same designs being used by tattoo artists. In the 1940s, you know, people are getting Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse or portraits of Gary Cooper. and when we get through to the 1990s and beyond, people are copying designs that they're seeing on their favourite celebrities. I mean, there's even, again, I lay this out in the book, an example, as early as 1929, Elsa Schiaparelli, the famous French fashion designer, is doing a kind of tattoo themed knitwear. So you can you can put on this bathing suit that's covered in tattoo designs that make you look, you know, sort of scandalously as if you might even be naked, because their bathing suits are knitted in this sort of bronzed skin toned wool. And tattooing becomes this kind of part of edgy fashion like 100 years ago, which is almost sort of the opposite way around to what you were just talking about, tattooing seeping back into fashion from people who are getting tattooed, you know, as well as things that happen in the opposite direction.
One thing I found interesting in the book was when you're talking about punishment tattoos. Yeah. So tattoos haven't always been voluntary things that people want to do. Where do we see that kind of happening?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons why tattooing is so important in lots of mainstream cultural traditions is it's demarcative of status. You know, it can mark you out as different from someone else, for good or for ill. It can encode gender, it can encode, you know, tribal affiliation or familial affiliation. Because it doesn't wash off and because it's not easily removed, it's also really useful for literally stigmatizing people, right? You know, that word stigma, which we get from Greek, it refers to literal marks on the skin, and the Greeks and the Romans and the ancient Chinese and in ancient Japan as well all used tattooing as a way of making visible criminals. The British Army too used tattooing to mark deserters. You could in ancient China be charged with a list of what were called ink crimes, so everything from kind of stealing to repetitious adultery. And if you did it severely enough, you know, and you were caught enough times, you would end up being tattooed in a place that was visible, often even on the face. Invading armies would also sometimes use tattooing to stigmatize or punish or even dehumanize people under their capture. Of course, that happened in Holocaust concentration camps. It was happening in the Korean War on both sides. Prisoners were tattooed with political slogans to which they did not agree, in order to kind of make them, you know, humiliate them, I suppose. And my favourite example of this is from Japan, where for a long time, punishment tattooing was done in the armpit, right? So it was done under the arms. And actually, as contemporary bodysuit tattooing developed in Japan, that much more artistic stuff that we might imagine when we think about Japanese tattooing developed, even to this day, traditional Japanese, like, artistic tattooing leaves gaps in this art, in this part of the body, because you weren't to be able to show that you weren't covering up or trying to efface your criminal tattoos, you know. And in fact, there's lots of examples, I mentioned a few in the book, of people who had been stigmatized with these punishment tattoos, of trying to remove them. Only one I ever found was successful, and that was a particular case in ancient Greece, where this guy went to a shrine and prayed to the right god, and the god miraculously got rid of it. So in the absence of divine intervention, tattoos are pretty difficult to get rid of.
So why the armpit? Why was that
choice? Well, I think it was, in that particular context, it was just a kind of way that, you know, it wasn't going to be on the face. It wasn't going to make your daily life particularly difficult. The level of punishment or the level of stigmatization was not, in those particular cases, intended to be totally disqualifying from public life. But it was enough to be like, if, you know, if I'm arresting you and you're coming to prison and I want to check if you've got a previous conviction, this is a good way of checking that, whether you've been a naughty boy or girl in the past, you know?
Yeah. From your kind of research, have you found that it was more unusual for women to be tattooed? And how have reactions to women with tattoos differed from those of men?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I find a lot, so I sort of track, you know, particularly in the Western context, articles, you know, newspapers, academics even saying, hey, guess what? Tattooing is not just for sailors anymore. Like, and a big part of that, and I found examples of that over 140 years. And a big part of those is often like, oh my God, you'll never believe what women are up to these days. There's a lovely one that I quote in my book, one of my favorites of those from the 1950s, where the woman's correspondent of the Hull Daily Mail, who's called pseudonymously Miss Humber, she's like, what, women are getting tattooed now? You wouldn't believe it. It's disgraceful. And the following week, these young girls write in, and this is, yeah, in the 1950s, they wrote in and say, look, we're not drunken sailors. We're getting pretty tattoos on our shoulders to show off in our evening dresses. Yeah, and that's as long ago as the 1950s. What those stories often have been a way of doing is showing pictures in newspapers of women in less clothing than would otherwise be appropriate in early 20th century press. So there's a lot of shock here. And of course, like, tattooing as an encodement of gender has become a very kind of constant trope of those responses. Many cultures, tattooing is exclusively a female practice. In the Arctic, for example, normative tattooing in Inuit cultures is exclusively a female practice. In some parts of the Pacific, although not in others, like in Fiji, for example, tattooing is something that women do, not men, do and wear. But yeah, in a mainstream kind of Western context, tattooing has been thought of as this masculinized thing. It comes with these associations of aggression and pain and conflict. I tell a story in the book of this sort of genderqueer person, genderqueer woman called Jo Carstairs, who lived in the early 20th century, who, you know, amazing what you can get away with if you're a billionaire. She was one of the richest people in the world at the time, inheritor of a fortune that came from her grandfather, who was part of Standard Oil. But she decided to sort of spend her fortune on becoming a powerboat racer, raising a private army, and of kind of defying as many gender norms as possible. She, as I said, chose to be called Jo rather than her birth name of Marion. She dressed as a man. She dated Marlene Dietrich very flamboyantly. And interestingly, in her case, she was tattooed with very kind of masculine sailor kind of tattoos. And again, in a sort of weird place that tattooing history can get us to, one of her mother's partners, one of her stepfathers, was a guy called Serge Voronoff, who was a Russian-French scientist who was experimenting with injecting people with monkey testicles in order to increase their virility. And
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
No, right. Yeah. And off the back of those experiments, there was some really interesting research happening with scientists and sociologists sort of thinking, well, look, if like masculinity and femininity are not, you know, if they can be changed, if we can just inject some people with enough monkey testicles, we get to some manliness. Maybe there's something culturally conditioned about masculinity and femininity, you know. And so a remarkably kind of progressive thesis for the 1920s. And two of the people that are interested in these monkey pulp experiments, a couple of German sociologists called the Vertings, they write a book about this phenomenon, and they have a whole chapter about tattooing. And they basically say, yeah, tattooing is a feature of a dominant sex in a society. So in a culture where men are dominant, tattooing becomes masculine coded. And they say that one of the reasons for that is that if you are a woman in modern society, you're not working, you're at the home, you've got time to make yourself beautiful. But tattoos, one and done. You decorate yourself, it's over. It's very efficient as a decorative practice, tattooing. And they compare that, you know, to ancient Egypt, which they view just a kind of female-dominated society where largely tattooing seems to have been done by women. And, yeah, have these ideas about that yes, tattooing encodes a certain kind of cultural dominance in modern society. That's to do with masculinity. And, yeah, I think it's super interesting, even in contemporary trans discourse, you know, lots of trans men are using tattooing to really accentuate or engage with their masculinity. And I found in my research letters or anguish letters from trans women and even kind of quite scathing reports by doctors treating transgender patients in the early part of the 20th century saying, you know, that because they were tattooed, they couldn't achieve their kind of, you know, the presentation of femininity that they required because it was so heavily coded with masculinity. So, yeah, that relationship comes with both interesting historical legacies, but also some really interesting possibilities if you want to kind of think about contemporary gender politics, you know.
When do we start to see tattooing be recognised as an artistic profession?
Yeah, well, tattooists have been, in the Western context again, calling themselves artists for a very long time. This guy called Sutherland MacDonald, who was the first real visible professional tattooer in the UK, who was working on Jermyn Street, he claimed, not entirely accurately, but certainly he popularised the term, to have coined the term tattooist as a contraction of tattoo artist, because tattooer made him sound too much like a plumber. So that was in the 1880s. Anthropologists had been making the analogy between tattooing and art even earlier than that. You know, when they were writing about tattooing in the Pacific, for example, they'd talk about it as an art. And I think, you know, art history as a profession hasn't generally taken tattooing particularly seriously for a very long time. And I have to say, to be really clear, I'm not interested in kind of bestowing upon tattooing the status of art. It doesn't need me to do that. And in fact, ironically, art historians are the least interested in doing that than anyone, in saying something is or isn't an art form. I want to kind of think about what happens if we think about something in the same way we might think about other forms of artistic practice. But I don't want to kind of say, yes, the great Dr. Lodder says tattooing is art now. But even the institutional art world has been putting tattooing in art galleries in an art sense since the 1950s. You know, there was a tattooer included in the Black Eyes Lemonade show in the Whitechapel in 1953. There was a solo show of tattoo art held at the Camden Art Gallery in 1971. And the same artist who did that, a guy called Les Skous, he was giving lectures at Bristol Art School around the same time. So, you know, even though, again, these cliches, oh, tattooing is an art form now, you know, it's come to become this great modern art form. Tattooists have been thinking about themselves and talking about themselves as artists for, you know, at least as long as I've been alive, and certainly back into the second half of the 20th century.
I had always thought of perhaps people had their tattoos, it was a personal thing, they were probably hidden, they did have them. Have examples of people kind of not flaunting them exactly, but wanting people to see them?
Well, I think those two things sort of go in tandem, right? So lots of tattoos, most tattoos, I suppose, in a Western context where it's not part of our mainstream cultural tradition, have been hidden away. And so the tattoos that we've seen or even known about have been on people who've shown their bodies off. So people who are performers, or people who are rolling their sleeves up at work and digging the roads, right? Or actually aristocrats who are showing them off, you know, for a little bit of shock value at nice effete parties. And so this vast majority of kind of vernacular quite normal tattooing is invisible, has been invisible, even to historians. And I think it's really interesting how those two things, those visibility issues, build to a kind of more a particularly narrow idea about who gets tattooed and why. You know, I again talk in the book about early studies of tattooing by criminologists, and what criminologists are doing is they're looking at prisons where there is lots of tattooing happening, and actually where there are lots of bodies that can be studied, and go, oh, there's loads of tattoos here, tattooing must be linked to criminality, right? But trying to look at tattooing more broadly is much harder. But of course, like, the flip side of that is to say that even now when tattooing is so visible, more visible than ever, undeniably, even though that's not a break from the past, it's a continuation. There's no now and then, but there is a kind of, I think, undeniable idea that tattooing is more visible than ever. But it's never going to be fully acceptable, because even when it's being patronised by kings and members of the House of Lords or university lecturers like myself, it's still something which is a bit weird and a bit against our cultural context, a bit transgressive. And so I think, weirdly, what this kind of constant story of skepticism tells us is that no matter how visible, no matter which people get tattooed, it's never fully gonna, against our cultural context, gonna become this completely acceptable practice. And I think I'll be talking about this probably for the rest of my career, because weirdly, the story of like Edward the Seventh getting tattooed isn't quite a story of acceptance. It's a story of actually like precisely why tattooing is sort of so stubbornly strange. Yeah. And it does make me laugh, and I lay loads out throughout the book, and particularly in the conclusion, it does make me laugh that there are these kind of, oh my God, you'll never guess who's getting tattooed now stories, you know, including ones about university lecturers from around the time I was born, including one that I am very fond of from 100 years ago that says, you know, tattooing has passed from the savage to the sailor, from the sailor to the landsman, and is now to be found beneath many a tailored shirt, right? That's from 1926. Mm. The fact that those cliches persist, and the fact that, the stories that you just alluded to persist, is because there is something weird about marking yourself permanently, changing a relationship with time, with willingly undergoing pain, with being touched by a stranger, all those things we have to do that we're not generally comfortable with in contemporary culture, you know. So yeah, I think that's also something I, you know, in some respects, and I had a tattooist tell me this years ago, you know, stop telling people that like aristocrats were tattooed, because I make my living tattooing 18-year-olds who think it's edgy, right? And of course, like, you know, I'm a middle-aged white academic. If ever I was edgy, I'm certainly not now. But like, I think the reason this book is interesting to people, hopefully, and certainly why I have a career, is because there is something about this that intrigues people, even if they are kind of cynical about it. And my goal is not to try and say, oh yeah, tattooing's completely fine and acceptable and always has been. Quite the opposite, really. I think it's the persistence of this cliche is indicative of its, you know, incurable strangeness against a Western cultural norm.
That was Dr. Matt Lodder, senior lecturer in art history and theory at the University of Essex. Painted People: Humanity in 21 Tattoos is on sale now, published by William Collins. Matt's written a feature sharing the stories of tattooed people from history for the January issue of BBC History Revealed. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.